ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're the Prime Minister. What's your first move? Make Australia a green energy superpower. Fix the housing crisis. Treat mental health as a national priority. The economy, stupid, is talking about what Australia could become if we had the courage to choose it. Search for The Economy Stupid and look out for Choose Your Own Australia. Find it wherever you get your podcasts and the ABC Listen app.
Welcome to Late Night Live Summer. I'm David Marr, coming to you from Gadigal land. Zane Grey wrote westerns in the 1920s and 30s. His books made him a millionaire and shaped Hollywood westerns that were watched in every city and bush town in Australia. Zane Grey was feted everywhere, not just as a writer, but a celebrity adventurer. Until now, his adventures in this country have been little known. Zane Grey later, but first, since 1748, at the direction of the King of Naples, people have been digging through the ash heap covering Pompeii to see what they could find. And the work continues. Every few months, it seems, fresh finds are reported, not just paintings and sculptures, but discoveries about the life of the city when Vesuvius blew its top in 79 AD. Under its new director, Gabriel Zugtriegel, appointed in 2021 at the age of 39, the largest excavation project in over 50 years has got underway. Gabriel joins me now from Pompeii to talk about the site and his new book, The Buried City, Unearthing the Real Pompeii. Gabriel, welcome to Late Night Live.
Hello, everybody.
Hey, how does a young German become director of Italy's most famous historic site?
I have no idea. I was actually very surprised myself. Of course, I had applied for the job, but I think it took quite some courage on behalf of the Minister of Culture to appoint someone like me. Probably, I had worked in Italy. I had directed another site, Paestum, a Greek colony, a fantastic place. And maybe my work there had convinced people that I was the right person. Anyhow, it's a great honor, an enormous responsibility, especially the conservation of the site. It's more than 13,000 rooms excavated in more than 2.5 centuries. So it's really a great challenge, but also, of course, for us archaeologists, Pompeii is like, you know, the Vatican of archaeology.
But how can there be anything left to excavate after 2.5 centuries? Surely by now it's done.
Well, actually, there's about 1/3 of the ancient city that is still unexcavated. Our plan is not to excavate everything, because you always have to remember that you can only excavate once, right? The layers, the exact find spots, all that. Either you document it or it's lost. And so we have to be very, very careful. We cannot exclude that in the future, maybe there will be new technologies that help us get even more data out of excavations in Pompeii. So we're actually not excavating as much as we can inside the city. We excavate more outside the city. There are villas and farmsteads, and it's an area we know relatively little about. So that's our strategy. And in Pompeii, it's really fantastic, because everything you do, you always get a lot of surprises. It's always different, always new things. And even if you start to look at the things that already have been excavated, like, for example, human skeletons, today we can do DNA analysis.
Of course.
We can find out so much more about the people who lived here.
Are there fresh ways of digging? Are you finding fresh ways of digging all the time?
Fresh ways of digging in the set of new methodologies.
New technologies, new methodologies.
Yeah, we are always kind of looking and checking new possibilities, not only for excavation, for analysis. Today it's possible to know if you find a pottery shirt, you can try to find out with chemical analysis what this pot contained, milk, wine, whatever, but also for the conservation of the site. But it's difficult in Pompeii. It's difficult because there's only one Pompeii. It's really a unique site, unique conservation condition. So there's really not much benchmarks you can look at. There's no other site where you can say, okay, let's do it like them. Of course, we are in contact with many other UNESCO sites, but it's really, you have to find, often in Pompeii, you have to find the solution. And if you don't, as a team working here, nobody will, because there's no other Pompeii.
Is there now technology that tells you what is under the ground before you begin to strip the ash away?
There is. There's for quite a few years now in archaeology, we're doing a lot of prospection, geophysical, so you can see the magnetic response of the underground structures and so forth. So that, unfortunately, in Pompeii doesn't really work. So we're still relying basically on excavation. We can try to kind of imagine what's under the unexcavated part of the site by drawing conclusions from what has been excavated already. But as soon as you excavate, then you understand that there's still more and still so much more to find out.
What's the most remarkable discovery since you've been director at Pompeii?
It's hard to tell.
Give us a list.
I'm sad to say. It depends on you. I mean, I could now mention frescoes like the one we discovered in February, a huge fresco showing scenes from a Dionysian kind of feasting and maenads, women in ecstasy and so forth, music, dancing. That's quite unique. It opens new perspectives on the study of ancient religion and ritual. But then, on the other hand, you find things that might seem not so important, traces of daily life. I always will remember the moment we discovered charcoal drawings of children who had been 5-6 years old, who evidently had been in the amphitheater and seen those brutal, bloody gladiator games, and then they got home and were drawing on the walls. Maybe they were then
little bastards
drawing
on the walls.
Parents, but they evidently had seen these scenes and were in their own very childish way drawing these figures on the wall, which is very touching because you have to imagine these children, you know, being exposed to that kind of entertainment, violence, and then in their little hats, elaborating what they had seen.
It seems to me that an illustration of how remarkable Pompeii is, that you found a bedroom with three beds and all of the equipment in it, and it seems to sum up what you call in your book the Pompeii effect. Explain.
Well, it's the eruption, Mount Vesuvius. There are two phases basically. It starts around noon on August 24th. Big explosion, smoke, ash rising to the sky, more than 30 kilometers height. And then you get the lapilli, small pumice stones falling from the sky. And that goes on until the next morning, early next morning. So in the meantime, there's a layer of almost 3 meters Maybe you can translate it into Australian yards.
Gabriel, we have meters. We've had them since 1966, but let's just pass on.
Okay.
Yes.
So almost 3 meters, people can't get out of the doors and houses anymore. Houses start to collapse under the weight and earthquakes going on. And then it's over. It stops and people think, well, finally, and maybe we can get out of the city. And they start, the city, you almost can't recognize it anymore. So they start coming out of their houses where they had taken cover. And then phase two starts. The huge column of ash and toxic gases starts to collapse in itself. And you get these avalanches, these waves of hot ash, almost 400 degrees Celsius. And it just rolls over Pompeii, killing all life that is still in the city and covering the victims. The ash becomes very solid soil. The bodies decompose and leave an empty space in the ash. And you can then pour plaster into these empty spaces, void spaces underground when you excavate. And you get kind of from the negative, the imprint, you get the form of the original corpses and other objects. Like wood and leather, all that is organic and decomposes, leaves, if it's in this ash layer, it leaves these empty void spaces. And so what we did in Civita Giuliana, which is a site just outside Pompeii, it was a great, marvelous villa. That is all these villas contained beautifully painted rooms. But then there were also enslaved workers, which is something we sometimes tend to forget. This was a society where up to a third of the population lived in slavery, exploited in chains. Sometimes they had more freedom, but still they were considered the property of someone else. And especially in agriculture, this must have been very, very common. And so you have the owner's part, and then you have the slave's quarter, and you see all these little rooms, 16 square meters. And in this particular one, we found 3 beds, very simple, no mattress, kind of net on them, and then the blanket just thrown there as it was in 79 AD. And 3 people living there. 1 bed was a bit shorter, so you can imagine maybe a child or more children. No pavement, no floor, no paintings, of course, on the walls. So you can see kind of the other side of this ancient society, the suffering, the exploitation, but also the attempt by these people to still maintain some minimum level of dignity and of you know, comfort. And every one of these beds had a water jar beneath, and so people still try to live their lives, of course. And so you start really wondering about what this means for our image, our idea of Roman antiquity. And you have to see it both the beauty, the art, the philosophy, but also these brutal and dark sides of the story.
One of the discoveries that you've made is that Pompeii was bigger than you thought, than was originally thought.
Well, it actually was bigger, not in the sense that, you know, more houses, but
no.
More people.
Yeah,
living in the same number of houses. So probably more cramped, more precious, the space. There was more competition. There were people who had marvelous large houses with a garden of, I don't know, 400 square meters or so. And then there were others who lived maybe an entire family on, you know, 12 square meters. But then you had an upper floor, and so all very cramped. People lived there, worked there, slept there, and it was just next door. So what you see is a society where you have stark social contrast and hierarchies. But what you don't get in Pompeii is what many of our modern cities have, that you have, you know, the areas where more rich people live and then the poor areas. In Pompeii, it's all mixed. It's all interwoven.
And another thing that you now see the city as more Greek than it had originally been thought, more permeated by Greek sculpture, bit by Greek art, by Greek thinking.
Well, yeah, that's something that in a way always was noted, but I think only with the ongoing excavations and the study of the texts, inscriptions, graffiti, paintings, you fully can understand what this means. We tend to think about Pompeii as a Roman city, which is, of course, true. People spoke Latin from a certain moment onward. They didn't speak Latin in the beginning, the first centuries of Pompeii. They spoke a local Italic language. And so it's technically a Roman city. But then you get so much Greek culture. You get it in the houses. The paintings are almost all Greek mythological stories. You get it in the inscriptions. You get it in the young people who were learning Greek as we today learn, English or Spanish or whatever. And it was so important to learn Greek for politicians and philosophers because kind of the high culture, the model was Greek culture. In the Eastern Mediterranean, during the whole Roman imperial period, Greek was the official lingua franca, the language everybody knew. Just one example, the New Testament is written in Greek because people wanted it to be read by a large number of readers. And so they decided to write it in Greek, not in Latin. People were learning Greek. And you also have many people from Greece and from the Eastern Mediterranean who were native speakers in Pompeii. And today, by doing these DNA analysis, we can fully understand the extent of this Mediterranean connectivity. We see people from all over the place and beyond. British islands, Eastern Mediterranean, North Africa. So people who may have come often as enslaved workers, but also as merchants, as travelers. So it was a highly connected society, the Roman Empire.
Is it that Greek flavour that gives Pompeii its erotic reputation?
Well, certainly it did for the ancient Romans. They had actually no tradition that was particularly open toward an idea of, you know, erotic sophistication and erotic art and writing of poetry and so forth. Then they get in contact with the Greek culture first, only on an elite level. But then the Romans conquer actually Greece. And so there's a massive influence of Greek culture into Roman Italy. And with this, you know, you have art and mythology and poetry and literature. And you get also things like, sex manuals written by Greek women who were prostitutes, supposedly, and so forth. And the Romans really didn't know how to deal with this. They were fascinated on the one hand, yes, but on the other hand, they feared that their ancient virtue and, you know, they were sober and you know, they would be warriors and farmers and politicians And so they always fear that this might be compromised by this new sophisticated culture.
But Gabriel, they still are.
Maybe.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr. I'm talking to Gabriel Zugtriegel, who is the director of Pompeii. Gabriel, crime must be a real consideration for you in your job, because the looting of archaeological sites is a vice that has been going on for centuries, and surely Pompeii is a target for the huge underground trade in old objects.
Well, hopefully Pompeii, the ancient city, not anymore, because now we have, you know, a fence and guards.
A fence?
Of course. The park, you pay a ticket to come in, but it's all very well protected. The problem is outside Pompeii, because you have exactly the same fabulous conditions for the conservation of ancient artworks and frescoes and buildings outside as you have inside the city. So you have their villas and small settlements and tombs and so forth. And so as long as there's a market, unfortunately, an international market of illegal trafficking of ancient artworks. So you'll always have the problem, especially in places like Italy, where there's so much still underground. And you have people here excavating from their houses sometimes, from their basements, tunnels to explore the ancient structures. And they, of course, are only the kind of the part of a chain, of a network, which is usually then organized through the organized crime.
Yes.
The Camorra, the mafia, who have connections to the international markets through, you know, Switzerland and other countries, and then place these objects on the market. And then it's extremely difficult to trace the origin of these works back. And that's why we have an agreement with the local state attorney to, as much as we can, monitor and contrast these activities. But as I said, as long as people buy it, so please, if you have any opportunity to
do not buy,
like politics are also of museums sometimes buy things, so please make your voice being heard that you don't want to see things that don't have a clear clear provenance and a history.
The tunnels, as you describe them in the book, were quite remarkable. They were long tunnels.
A network of tunnels are quite scary if you look at them. Very straight, narrow, dark. People had to crawl there. So it was also linked to a huge risk for the people who are doing this, these illegal excavations. And yeah, so it's astonishing. We still don't have the complete map in this case of Civita Giuliana, where a few years ago such illegal excavations were discovered by the local authorities, and then we started together with them to excavate scientifically in this place, that we still don't have the complete map, because it's so dangerous to enter these tunnels. So sometimes we try to use robots who go inside and laser scanners and so. But it's quite astonishing the criminal energy that was harassed harness to explore this villa.
It sounds like war.
Well, it is a battle we're fighting, but it's really important, and I think the finds show that, you know, the real worth of the villa of Civita Giuliana, for me, is Well, yeah, there are painted rooms, but the possibility to look into the life spaces of enslaved workers 2,000 years ago, that's really the historical treasure. But it's something you can't sell on the market. It's the context, right? The story that's behind it. That's the real value.
And that's the underlying argument of your book, is it not? That the people who come to Pompeii see beautiful things, they come to see treasures, but you would prefer that they reflected on the life of the city rather than the sort of the remains of the city.
Well, I think there's a great history and value in suffering also, and art often is, well, it's beautiful paintings, but the stories, why do they always, great literature, like great artworks, they often deal with suffering, and so does the history of Pompeii. The site was destroyed, many people died. And I think this is always an opportunity to get in contact with our own stories and suffering and losses we have suffered in our lives, and to deal somehow collectively and creatively with that, and to not suppress it, and to, it's a way of, freeing ourselves, actually, as I see it, to get in touch with this common humanity and kind of rediscover ourselves as part of it. We are, at the end, just as fragile and precarious are our lives as those of the people who died in 79 AD. They started their day 24th of August, just like we started our day today, without thinking of a deadly eruption. So I think excavating and visiting Pompeii is always also in some way an excavation in ourselves, in our memory, in our souls.
Gabriel, thank you for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you.
I've been speaking to Gabriel Zugtriegel, who has been director at Pompeii since 2021, about the latest excavations and about his beautiful book, The Buried City, Unearthing the Real Pompeii. My EP has handed me a note. I said in that interview that we went from yards to metres in 1966. The note reads, "Fool, it was 1974. You were alive then and should know." Thanks, Jack. Coming up, when a Hollywood legend came to Australia to fish. Zane Grey was huge. He wrote westerns. From the 1920s, Hollywood turned them into blockbuster films. He was a celebrity and a big game fisherman. That brought him to Australia in the 1930s, chasing big fish, a secret love affair, and he hoped a movie that would get him out of some financial difficulties. It would be a movie about a shark. In fact, Jaws before its time. Vicky Hastrich, fisherwoman and author, has written a new biography of the man. It's called The Last Days of Zane Grey, The Untold Story of a Hollywood Legend in Australia and His Hunt for the Great White Shark. I'm delighted to say that Vicky is sitting opposite me in our state-of-the-art Late Night Live studios. Vicky, welcome to the show.
Oh, hello, David. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, look, you argue that fishing and writing are, in some way, similar enterprises. Please explain.
Well, David, I think the fact is that writers and fishermen are putting a line down into another realm, and we're never quite sure what's going to come up, something surprising, mercurial, beautiful. And I feel that was a link that people don't appreciate when they think of Zane Grey and his love of fishing, that writing and fishing were two very similar enterprises for him. They certainly are for me.
I'm really convinced by this argument because there's another thing as well. Fishermen have to know what to throw back.
Ah, so true.
So true. So true. It was love of fishing that brought you to this story and the discovery that there was a beach in Australia called Zangray Beach.
Well, yes, it was just a complete accident that I stumbled across this story. I was idly researching the Western as a genre, and I very soon came across the name of Zane Grey as the American writer who, if he didn't invent it, he certainly popularised it. And I'd never heard of him before, and a little further research popped up the name of the Zane Grey Caravan Park at Bermagui.
Oh, a caravan park, yes.
And I just thought, that doesn't compute. Why is a south coast town in New South Wales, why do they have a caravan park named after this writer? And that is what led me on the grand trail that has been this book.
What was it that Zane Grey brought to the Western that made his name synonymous with the Western? I mean, this was a mighty name that hardly anybody knows anymore. But what did he bring to the Western?
I think it was his mixture of romance and action.
A bit saucy and a bit violent.
Yes, definitely saucy, and that the women in his books were strong, resilient, independent women. They weren't wimps by any means. They may have ultimately needed
a bit of protection.
A hero and a protection in the end. Yeah. But they were very capable women, and so it meant that these books had a wide appeal for women and men. This combination was what made it such a hit.
I love that detail in your book, that Zane Grey had told Hollywood that the filming of his books must take place in Arizona. And probably not much of the great Western expansion of the United States happened in Arizona, but that's what we think of, don't we?
We do. Those landscapes of mesa and canyon. You know, he introduced Americans to their own deserts and wild places. And, of course, that went global. So, yes, it was a stroke of genius because they're such dramatic landscapes. And at first it was a huge impost on Hollywood. It was very rudimentary.
They had to travel.
They had to travel. And the first of his films was made in 1916. So, you know, it wasn't a well-developed industry.
Have you seen that one?
No,
I haven't.
It was, yes, silent.
I presume that prints survive. I mean, they're all still there.
Yes, you know, some are missing, but that was Riders of the Purple Sage, the book that he's most famous for.
Remade in 1996?
Remade many times, five times.
Five times.
Yes, across the decades. And that's also what helped to make him so wealthy, because his bestsellers made him money. They were serialised in magazines as well. And then, of course, they were made and remade into films each time, earning him really big advances.
And then there was a brand new sport that he was a master of, a promoter of as well, big game fishing. Now, surely big game fishing has always been with us.
Oh, no. Really, it's a sport that only began around the 1910s. There was one club earlier on Santa Catalina Island in about 1897. That was the very first in the world, but very few people could participate in this sport, and it gradually expanded. But Grey was an early pioneer, and he fished in Long Key in the Florida Keys and off the coast of California, and then went further afield because he was wealthy. He could afford to turn himself into what was the world's he became known as the world's best fisherman, and way before Hemingway was known for that.
In fact, aren't there some some rather grim speculations around that Hemingway copied Zane Grey.
Well,
I'd love an academic to prove that, yes.
Well, it's thought that Hemingway styled his book The Old Man and the Sea on a world record marlin that Grey caught in Tahiti, and because that was something that Grey had to wait 80, 90 days before he actually hooked that fish.
On Late Night Live, I'm talking to Vicky Hastrich, author of The Last Days of Zane Grey. Now, Vicky, everywhere he went, he brought a PR team with him. He was always news. So when he turned up in Sydney in 1936, it was an event.
It was huge. The media came down to meet the boat he arrived on, the Mariposa, and clamoured around him. Everything he said or did was news. Australians just went nuts for him and came to his camp down in Bermagui in hundreds, in thousands even. He estimated that he signed over 5,000 photographs in the first fortnight of his arrival.
Photographs he just happened to have with him.
Yes. Well, he was rather put off by the grubby scraps of paper that were put forward to him to sign. Some people travelled hundreds of miles to just get a glimpse of him. It was almost like Beatlemania in the 60s. That's how enamoured we were with him.
And across the country at this time, his Westerns were in all the pictures.
Yes, and his books, you know, they were passed around shearing sheds and they were a kind of social currency. Everybody knew his name as well as their own prime minister.
And he was out in this country chasing fish.
Mm.
Did he catch his fish?
He did. It was part of his plan not only just to enjoy the fishing, but he wanted to capture headlines to keep his lights high and to help him do deals because, as you mentioned, his finances were shaky. But first of all, he was after swordfish, marlin, we call them more now. And then he gradually became more enamoured with the idea of bagging himself a giant great white shark.
Before we get to the sharks, just on swordfish, there's this extraordinary thing in your book that people doubted whether they were edible.
Oh, yes.
They're almost the best fish.
Oh, this was hilarious that people needed convincing because actually a controversy lit up because the RSPCA got involved and were concerned that this was cruelty to animals and
Cruelty to fish,
and they were requesting that, you know, he be sent away and this pastime should be stopped. And Zay Gray's riposte was to say, look, these fish are edible. There's a market for them in the US and they shouldn't be wasted. They're edible. And people were just mortified at the thought. They just, oh, no, it's not possible. So they had to, taste tests were arranged so to convince the public. It was hilarious.
But you've got no recipes in your book. Marcella Hazan has some fabulous swordfish recipes, but that's by the by. So he turned his attention to an indisputably hostile, the shark. Is the shark a fish?
Yes.
Yes. Sorry, we've arranged that the shark is a fish. And was he successful chasing sharks? It was a big tussle, was it not?
Well, initially he caught a small shark moving his camp from Bermagui to Bateman's Bay, and he had seen a huge shark underneath the boat one day, and that's what really captured his imagination. But he'd only ended up catching a small great white himself, a fish he'd never caught before. And he thought this was going to be something really worthy of his talents. And he wasn't successful catching one on his first trip to Australia, despite needing to for the film he was going to make in Hayman Island. However, he returned to Australia with that aim in mind and went to Port Lincoln in 1939, out to those wild, remote waters to try and find the ultimate opponent, and he did.
Now, just while we're on shore for the moment, on which of his trips did he discover Lola?
Well...
And who was she?
Lola was Zane Grey's secret Australian lover. He was a man who had many lovers in his lifetime, but interestingly, they were always really long-term affairs. These women were his friends as well as his lovers, really. And his wife, Dolly, who was an amazing woman, knew all about them and tolerated them, but wished this wasn't the case. She was a realist that he was never going to be faithful. And Lola had written to Zane Grey in about 1933, praising one of his books. She was an Australian poet, a middling poet who by the 30s was not well known anymore, was not being published much in the newspapers as she had once been. But she wrote praising his work. And this amazing rapport quickly built up between them. And in no time, though they'd never met, they were declaring each other, longing to meet each other. And indeed, the letters even sort of became quite racy. And then once Grey was determined to come to Australia, here was the moment when they would meet. So how would the meeting go?
Lola Gornall, we're talking about, Gornall, did they meet in Bermagui?
No, they met at the Australia Hotel.
Ah, oh, I was hoping for a Bermagui meeting at the caravan park.
Oh, no, no, no. This was on the first night Grey arrived. They met. Lola had a secret she'd been keeping from him, which was that she was, in fact, 52 years old instead of the 25 years old that he thought she would be.
Oh, the fibber! But he was not...
He was not deterred. I think she was exotic, beautiful, intelligent. He called her a genius. So he was still... totally interested, and he made trips backwards and forwards from Bermagui to pursue the affair, which gradually became more and more intimate.
I hope that Lola Gornall's books are issued these days with, on the cover, a genius, Zane Grey.
Well, Lola would have loved that to have been the case, but in fact, her books were never published. She was only published in newspapers. She had a manuscript of a novel which Grey tried desperately to help her with, introducing her to his agent in the US and his publisher, but they rejected her work. The fact was she really was pretty mediocre and perhaps even outdated already.
Mediocre and outdated. Thanks, Vicky. That will really send our listeners to the work of Lola Gornall.
I'm sorry, Lola. I have a fondness for her, but her writing, I'm afraid, is not her best asset after all.
Now, let us roll forward once again to 1939 and the pursuit of the great white shark. Did he ever land a great white shark?
Well, apart from the small Bateman's Bay one, in fact, he was not able to pull in the enormous shark he actually hooked up. So this is the sort of last set piece of the book. It's his giant last adventure. And he comes face to face with, really, it's death staring him in the face. This giant great white looms up over the side of the boat, puts its head completely out of the water and... he hooks this fish, but the fish beats him. And in fact, he wasn't, he was at this point a reduced man because in between the two trips to Australia, he suffered a stroke. He turned 64 when he arrived in Australia and then, yes, 12 months later, had a stroke by a river in Oregon. And he fought back to retain, to regain his physical strength. And he got a long way towards that, but he just wasn't the same person. So this final battle was something that was really almost beyond him, and here he was facing his mortality, really, once he stared into that great white's face.
He was a smoker and a drinker, I suppose.
He was not.
Oh.
He had signed the pledge as a young man. His mother insisted on it, and he'd never smoked. He was a very fit man, very attractive man. His wife, Dolly, said, you have easily the most magnetic personality of anyone I've ever met. And this was really interesting to me, because that wasn't the man I met on the page in his letters.
No, you find another person.
I...
Tell.
I found him to be quite... restrained. There's only one hint of his humour, and that's in any marked degree, and that's an article he wrote about a shocking truck ride he had in Queensland, and that is a very nice dry piece of writing.
Where's that? A newspaper?
In a newspaper, yeah.
Ah, Trove. Use Trove, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, my
and
goodness.
And find Zane Grey in an Australian newspaper.
I cannot sing the praises of Trove enough. I'm getting distracted from the other story, but Trove is... This book could not have been written without Trove, because he was so thoroughly reported on by the papers.
Of course, the publicity machine worked, and it was in all the papers.
Yes, and it meant that I could track his daily activities, almost hourly activities in some ways, and cross-reference them, because different papers carried the stories. In a way, it was like having a GPS tracker on him. That's how I have this story.
There may be some listeners who don't know what Trove is, Vicky. Tell.
Well, Trove is the digitised newspaper collection, which is hosted by the National Library of Australia. It's fully searchable. It's the most amazing resource.
It's free.
It's free. And if you're looking up somebody like I was, who has an unusual name.
Ah, yes. Yes, yes, yes.
That was the big help.
It's the most beautiful one. It opens the past of this country to us, Trove.
We now have access to all these stories we could never have put together before.
Now, Vicky, this man who was so famous that, you know, squads of journalists would turn up at any wharf where he arrived, he was followed around Australia by crowds of fans and cameras, is now almost unknown. How can such fame just melt away?
It's amazing to me that he's fallen from social memory so far. But I think... I'd say it was the closing of an era, with his death coming in 1939, because only a few months after returning home from that fateful Port Lincoln fishing expedition, he did in fact die of a massive cardiac arrest at home. And so then, of course, war was declared, and it's very much a closing of an era then. And although his novels continued to be published posthumously for years, because he had so many manuscripts in the cupboard, his publisher had a huge stack because he really dashed them off. Yet still, I put it down to the war and everybody moving on from that, certainly in Australia.
Yeah, it was another time.
Mm.
And we had other heroes. And so Zane Grey is remembered in this country mainly by a caravan park in Bermagui. There's a nearby literary festival, a wonderful little literary festival at a place called Tathra. Now, I'm very surprised that they don't have a Zane Grey Prize, for instance, each year. I'm going to suggest it to the organisers.
That is a great idea for nature writing, because that was his greatest, I think, attribute as a writer, that he really did render landscapes beautifully and introduce people to the value of wilderness beyond what could be extracted from it.
What did he think of us in the end?
Interestingly, he held a press conference before he left Australia for the first time, and he told the reporters that he thought Australians were a very outward, forward-looking people, open, and he loved that about them. But he also told us that we did not regard or respect our Aboriginal people as we should. He had a great respect himself for Indigenous people. In the US, he wrote a book called The Vanishing American, which was one of the first books in literature, American literature, to criticise public policies, government policies to do with Native Americans. That was The Vanishing American, that book, 1925, that came out. And here in Australia, he went out of his way to have interactions with Indigenous people down on the south coast of New South Wales, and again on Hayman Island when he went there to shoot the White Death movie.
How does the Native American emerge in his westerns?
He is very sympathetic towards them. I think he does feel that they're a doomed race, which is not something we would say
idea.
Now.
Yeah, yes, that old idea.
And that really was upsetting to him, because he could see from his own travels and experiences with Native American people, which was extensive, he could see that their connection and knowledge of the land was of a whole other order than what white people could grasp.
And yet the settlers, the pioneers, were his heroes.
Yes, yeah. I think he did feel this inevitability, that a kind of almost Darwinian philosophy.
Which was strong in Australia as well.
Yes, and it seemed like a realistic view, given the terrible treatment of these people too. How could they survive such awful disregard?
Are his books read at all today?
Well, I think it's a kind of niche interest, really, in America.
Not after people read your biography.
No, and of course some are better than others. His Riders of the Purple Sage, the classic book he's most well known for, that is on the US Library of Congress, their list of 100 books that shaped America. So the Western, and was the only Western on it. So he does have this important place and will never disappear entirely for that reason.
Vicky, thanks so much for joining us on the show.
Thank you, David. It's been great.
I've been talking to Vicky Hastrich, author of The Last Days of Zane Grey. And that's the show. On our next, the senior diplomats who are taking very seriously the task of preventing war in space over the trillions in resources out there. And we revisit the true crime adventures of our last outlaws, the Governor Brothers, whose crimes shook Australia on the cusp of federation. Thank you.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.